is the XR Motion Podcast with your host, Michael Steinberg.
All right, welcome to the podcast. Guys, I am very excited today. We have an amazing guest. Found him on Instagram and I had to hit him up because his work is just amazing. You guys know I always say this, go check out his work right now if you can. It's at I Am Vernon Roberts. That's our guest, Vernon Roberts today. Instagram or pretty much all social media, it's I A.M. Vernon, that's V-E-R-N-O-N, Roberts, R-O-B-E-R-T-S, or check it out at iamvernonroberts.me. Well, just to give a little background, Vernon, he is a 3D generalist with a deep background in branding, print design, and color management. Living in Nashville, Tennessee, he started his career as a graphic designer working at a sign shop. From there, he went on to work for a commercial printer company. And for 8 years, he worked for the printer producing everything imaginable from magazines and posters to Perfect Bound and, is it Smith-Swen books?
Smythe-Swen books, or I've heard it called a lot of different things.
You're going to have to tell me all about that. This is like a duo bio.
I had a huge career switch. Very hard to pull off, yeah.
Well, it's crazy because I'm loving all these magazines that you sent. And I've been looking at your background. And it's cool to go from the magazine and printing industry. I had a roommate who is into that stuff. There's just so much more focus on like color theory and a lot of interesting ways you have to look at just design. Just to finish up, so just in the bio, you get into 3D, yeah, and you're doing a lot of freelance general stuff, working with studios and agencies. So what got you into the printing industry?
Oh, well, I went to school for graphic design or an art school, and when I graduated, I knew it was very competitive trying to land a job working for someone. And so I took an internship in a pre-press department for a commercial printer, and I knew that the skills I learned in school applied there, but they applied kind of differently. So I didn't really get to do a lot of designing, but just even more technical expertise of layout work and things. And then after my internship, after I got out of my art school program, I knew that that had an upper edge of just landing a job. So I applied somewhere with my little internship background, and I ended up in pre-press. And then quickly promoted over the department after my boss had walked out one day. And that's the path that took me that direction. So I did some design and some branding, but I never was just like a graphic designer. It started getting really technical, and I just ended up being learning color management. And that ended up being my sole thing, like the first part after art school. Didn't really do any kind of 3D work in art school. That was not even the same at all.
So with the printing, I think it's kind of cool because with 3D work, a lot of times you're always working on a flat screen, and the way it's presented is usually exactly the same. It's a 16:9 format, and that's kind of your limitations. With printing, I'm guessing a lot of times you're working with different types of paper, probably different types of formats and different things. So that in itself, do you feel like that's ever challenging, having to rethink how this will look? And
well, it depended, I guess, on the client, what their expectation of what was possible, because I was always trying to be at the very top of my game at anything that I do. And so I was very aware of what was possible and what wasn't. And a lot of clients had lower expectations than what was really possible, and others had higher expectations of what was possible or what was realistic to be produced consistently across a long print run. Or it spread the gamut of all kinds of things. And mostly it always comes back to my biggest job when I was doing that was clients having an expectation of what their brand color was. It was usually like a solid color or a couple of colors that they wanted to make sure were exact. But at the same time, most people that are buying print never really had a way to communicate it, the color information. And this can be over a lot of people's head. But you say my color is whatever color it is. You could explain that through the PMS library, or you may have an RGB value, or you may have a CMYK value. And there's a whole lot of more information you need. And then when you start trying to ask the client or request the client this type of information, sometimes it's just way over their head and they don't really understand. So as a pre-press manager and color expert guy, pretty much I would be trying to educate the customer so that they could help establish their own standards, so that the printer could understand how to establish what they wanted their colors to be across everything, screens, printing, different kinds of paper. And then you could figure out what is possible. If you're printing on a green paper, of course, there's no way to hit the same kind of color that you want unless you put down a white base ink first or something. So, I mean, that's an extreme example, but some people would take a print sample on the press and they would stick it next to what was being pulled off the press. And I'd be like, I don't know where you got that. And it changes over time. I could go into a lot of details about this, but not in the podcast. I think that it would just confuse people. But yeah, I did a lot of communicating with the client and pressmen and just education all around too. And also physically building ICC profiles and profiling big presses and digital presses and proofers and just color management throughout the whole workflow. And it was important because analog devices, they drift and they have problems and they're old and not everybody can have a brand new press, and because it's expensive to have brand new gear. So yeah, I was just like, it's a full-time deal, just like trying to keep everybody on the same page and keep color management the same on every device. That's the print side, really. You know, InDesign, In and Out, Illustrator, Photoshop, basically building files or rebuilding files based on what a client was trying to achieve. It could be like a pop-up book with complicated die lines, anything you can imagine that people, whatever they can brainstorm up, I would try to help them execute that.
So were you doing the actual kind of designing of the documents that were getting printed up for things, or is it more just trying to figure out?
Every once in a while, but while I was working at the printer, I had two pre-press operators. They're kind of under me, slash designers, you know, graphic designers. And so they would work the jobs, and then we would have regular maybe newsletters and things that they would design and work directly with clients and design. But I didn't do much designing myself. I did rebrand that printer, and that was a huge branding project while I was there. So that was a lot of design work that I did. But mostly I didn't do much design because of the technical expertise, I guess, were way more in demand. So it made sense for someone else to design. I could give what I thought about things, but during that, not much design, just because of the role that I was playing there.
I'm always fascinated by different types of mediums. And printing, again, I think that's one of the craziest ones. But with printing, did you ever come across any, like, in particularly difficult challenges?
Yeah, well, for any printer, if anybody's listening to this, would know that solid colors, people will tell you certain colors are harder to print than others, but anything that's just a big area that's a solid color is very hard to print consistently, because you're going to see any little piece of trash that ends up in the press. You're going to see it on the sheet, or you're going to see anything that ends up on there, and it's going to be on the same sheet. Or even in digital printing, it's just hard to produce big solids because you can see any little problem with it. Same thing with a screen. Like if you have a screen with burn-in on it and you put a big solid on it, you're going to see the burn-in on the screen, if that makes sense. So if there's any problem with the press, you're going to have a density variation across the roller where in the middle, they've always run small sheets. So in the middle, you're going to have a different density than you will on the edges. So the pressman will have to try to adjust the ink keys to try to compensate. And for digital printing, like xerography, like toner-based printing, they'll have problems where they tend to run a certain sheet size the majority of jobs, and then they have a big job that's got a big solid, and it's all grainy, and they can't seem to produce a nice solid. So that's the number one thing I would say is the issue, solid colors.
When it comes to designing, is there any certain layout tricks? I mean, I'm sure for you it might be maybe redundant, but I'm just thinking that when you lay something out on a print, I'm trying to think if there would be any like issues of not printing on top of each other or colors that just wouldn't mix next to each other. Is there ever any issues like that kind of happen?
No, there are some things that, and I'll just say here, there are printers that may not have someone on staff with a high education in color management or a deep education in the advanced settings in the RIPs, the modern RIPs. And so what they'll do is ask the client to do crazy things with their files because they don't have a modern workflow or they don't have someone on staff to take care of the things the way they should. So one of the things that I would always hear from clients who did printing with other printers and then came to the printer that I was with, they would flatten their transparency on output. So out of InDesign, they would make a PDF and they would always flatten the transparency. And that causes all kinds of problems in the printing. The trapping engines that are in the rips can't trap the files as good as they could have, or they may have designed with PMS spot colors, like actual spot colors. So maybe they're not paying for a 5 or 6 color job. They're only paying for a 4 color job, but their file has several PMS colors in it. Now our rip would just go ahead and process those out. This is getting very technical, but what would happen is if they flatten their transparency, there's no way for us to process out their PMS colors if they have blending modes and things applied. They'll lose the overprint attributes and you'll end up with, if let's say you had a drop shadow that should have had a proper like multiply effect in it. If they use the PMS color in that drop shadow, then what happens is the PMS color gets an overprint attribute applied, and then as soon as we process out that PMS color, you end up with a box where the shadow is. So you may have heard people talk about images dropping out or shadows or type dropping out. It's not ever really dropping out. Usually it's not the case, especially if anybody's got any kind of modern RIP technology, anything that's somewhat recent that's using the Adobe PDF print engine. Usually it's a PMS color that we need to process out because they're only paying for a 4 color job, and that PMS color has an overprint attribute and that loses its overprint attribute, and so you get a white box. I know it's a very specific thing, but those are things that happen. So don't flatten your transparency out of InDesign or Illustrator. Just leave it live. And if your printer is complaining about it, then maybe, I don't know, if they gave you a really good deal on and it's the lowest bid, then maybe you just have to do what they ask. I've had printers even ask, or I've heard clients where they want you to build the spreads for them. Well, it's like they're doing a book and you have to do the pagination for them, which is a ridiculous request. So, and your audience may not know much about this, I don't know, but basically you should only be able to open InDesign, create a PDF, send the PDF to the printer, and they should take care of the rest. It doesn't matter if there's RGB images. It doesn't matter if there's live transparency. It doesn't matter if there's PMS colors. The printer should be able to run it through the rip, and it's smart, and it knows what to do. Yeah, that's some beef that I've had for a while. Just, yeah.
So with the printing, have you seen any advancements in the printing industry since you've started? And then also, is there any plans for like crazy printing technologies in the future? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, the last thing you mentioned, crazy printing technologies. So what you're going to see and what is out there now, just extremely expensive, is large format. When I say large format, I mean like a 40-inch sheet fed. I don't know how to explain any better than that, but basically sheet fed. It's not like traditional where you see the guys pouring the ink out in the rollers. It's inkjet based. So you have complicated, big, I think mostly they're, some of the print heads are made by Fuji, I think. Heidelberg has a press, Fuji has a press. Basically, it's like a big, giant inkjet printer. And what that allows is you to print one sheet if you want to. So the way it works now is you'll have so much make ready, and maybe like 500 sheets need to run through or more to get the color up. And then you may change it. Looking at it, you'll have a reference proof or whatever. But when it comes to a big, giant digital press, basically it's profiled with ICC profiles just like smaller presses are. And it's extremely accurate. The price per sheet is expensive, but it is getting less and less all the time. So that's where that's going. And what I've seen change is just the, I guess, the amount of programs that are out. IDE Alliance makes a lot of training programs and things for pressmen and pre-press managers, pre-press people, for like communicating color standards for brands. So like Coca-Cola trying to buy print or whoever they go through, and they're like, they've got their red. And how do you communicate to a printer digitally the red specifications? Well, it's a lab number, but it's a little bit more advanced than that. And the lab number changes based on like if you're printing on a foil or if you're printing on a different stock. So there's these PMS libraries that have lab, basically digital values for, they can even have companies like for Coca-Cola. They have all their specifications. So when you print on a foil, this is the number you're supposed to match. if you're printing on just one of their substrates, some cardboard or something like that, this is the digital number you're supposed to match when you print. And that way they can print all around the world and have the same digital standards. For a smaller client, not like Coca-Cola or someone, then that's an overhead that's too much for them.
Because you would have to essentially make that format for them.
That's right. They would come in and they might have a PMS book and it might have a swatch in it that they want. But one thing you'll learn after you've been doing color management is PMS books fade and they have a delta E of like 2 that can spread away from what the digital standard is. So they're not a good reference. They're just an idea. So they'll come in and they'll even have like a board or something, a paint chip or something, or product. And we'll measure it with a spectrophotometer and we'll measure it on all corners and get a variation and average the numbers together and come up with a digital standard for them and then store it in the RIP. And then every time they print, we know, oh, this is Bob's Red or whatever. And Bob's Red may be an actual true PMS. Maybe it's a PMS 485 or something, and that's a red. And maybe they don't know that. Maybe they just got a red that's close. And we say, hey, how about we go with a standard like 485? And they're like, okay, because they don't really know. And then that's their new standard. And so that's kind of what I would do. I would be like, kind of help them figure out what their standard should be. And then from then on, everyone understands it. But a lot of times, clients just have a print sample and it was like, it didn't match the last time. Well, somebody else printed that and they didn't print to some standard. I did a lot of like communicating what is possible and what is not possible.
Especially in print, it's so hard to get that brand color. I mean, I've even had clients come back that do the eyedropper looking for the exact hex code number to come off.
Oh, yeah.
They even get particular, you know, I've had some major clients where if you even have a logo that maybe goes near a logo and a slight drop shadow hits that logo and that changes their color, they get extremely upset by that. So I've just learned, do not ever have any alteration on a logo in any way, shape, or form. I mean, it's crazy. Like, they really do hyper focus on their colors. So I can't even imagine being in the printing industry where you have almost no control. I mean, you have a lot of control when you're at your level, but that's got to be just fascinating.
Yeah, you know, the lighting, there's something called metamerism, and it's where basically you can't just... Color management for a long time has been based on, well, if the press has this dot gain, then the color will be the same. And that is not true. So the color management standards also include what color are the lights in the booth and how bright are they, if that makes sense. So if you look at a proof, which is printed on an Epson probably, that's digitally to a standard like Grackle, and you know that's a Grackle proof and it's inkjet printed, but it doesn't matter. But it does matter if you look at it like under 3000 Kelvin lighting in your living room or something. So you have one print that's a sheet fed that's printed with ink on paper. Then you have another one that's printed inkjet, and you hold them next to each other and they're completely different. And you're like, why don't they match? Because the color management standard says that you have to look at both of them under 5000 Kelvin lighting at a certain brightness, D50, depending on what standard you're following, or they won't match at all. Because you can't make two different samples match that have different pigments under all lighting conditions. It's only one lighting condition.
Right, because that would be physically impossible. So there is a standard light.
And there's a reason why, because there's no way to match two different types of printing technologies and have the same color unless you have the same light too. Because one is made with little bitty dots. It's got like a stochastic style dot. And then the other one is a halftone pattern with line screens. They're completely different techniques on how to produce a print, but they can be calibrated with color management and ICC profiles, etc., under the same lighting condition. And that freaks people out because we used to put a little lighting indicator on every proof, and it says, hey, when you view this proof, you can only compare it to your printed sample in a booth that's certified whatever, D50. Otherwise, they won't match. And people would be like, well, I don't have a booth and it should just match. And I'm like, well, that's not possible because you can't match in all lighting. And I would explain it. And then some people would listen. And then some people would just be like, I'm just speaking a bunch of jargon. They don't. It's so much. And I'm like, well, that's just my job. That's just how it is. I'm not just feeding you a bunch of bull. That's really the way it is. If I could make it awesome, I would make it awesome in all lighting conditions and I wouldn't have to worry about it. But no, that's just how it is.
So you have a booth, and do you ever bring clients in there just to view it?
Oh, I don't have one. When I worked for the printer, I had one put in my office. They were selling a press, and there was a booth sitting there. And I asked them, can I have that booth and put it in my office? And it was all dirty and nasty. And we cleaned it up. And then I ended up with a booth in the office. And everyone loved it after that. So they would come in the office. They would go out in the press room, pull a sheet, come in the office. And they would be checking it and looking at it. And all the printers always have booths because they have to. Because they're pulling sheets and matching the proof. But yeah, and you can have a little booth. But if you're going to be like really serious and like picking at what is coming from your printer and not matching the proof, you also have to be really serious about, well, these are the limitations, and you have to view it under 5,000 Kelvin. It's very similar to daylight, so a very good close match would be just going outside and viewing the Epson inkjet proof versus what you got off press.
Like on a bright, sunny day?
Yeah, that would be close, but it's very similar. Like you go to Home Depot and you see the light colors, and you can buy 5,000 LED, or you can buy 6,000. Yeah, similar to that. Not, it's, of course, there's a lot more to the booth and the way that light is hitting the angle and all that. It goes on and on.
And that's just the craziest thing with print is there's so much more to it than you can ever imagine.
Oh, yeah. There's page translucency. If you lay one over top of each other, one is more opaque so the color looks darker. You can't do that. You have to lay them right next to each other. People, they look at it and just like, there's so many things that you just don't realize you do. Don't lay the sample right over top the other one. It'll always look darker.
Because, right, if you have, like, a thin page and you even are just holding it up at in itself.
If you hold it, that's right. If you hold it down and you go, it doesn't match, what you do is you slide it over and go, look, now it does. Basically, there's a standard for how white the background has to be that you're laying the paper on. And when you go to measure it, so wet ink is measured on, if you're following anything from Grackle or anything from IDE Alliance standards, wet ink is measured on a black background. And the dry standards are measured on white backgrounds. And the background has to be, you know, a certain luminance, like so bright. That matters a lot. It makes a color appear darker or lighter when you're just viewing them. And if one of your samples is on a different color background or whatever, they will look darker and lighter. Yeah, it gets really nitpicky and you start looking back at it and you start asking yourself, I asked people, I was like, does it really matter at this point? Like, we're really picking it. So, I mean, but whatever, you know, my job was to make sure that it was as close as possible. And I would say a very good close should be with like 2 delta E AB, something like that. That would be very close. You would never get better than that.
What is delta EAB, if you don't mind me asking?
So I feel like I shouldn't have said AB because it might have opened another conversation. But so delta E, just leave it at that right now. It's got to do with like the difference between two colors in lab color space. So if you measure a color and you get a lab number and that represents that color in 3D color space, it's weird we're talking about 3D, but it is a volume of color. It's a coordinate. And then you measure another color. Let's say one's the reference and one is what you printed. So the reference could be a digital number and then you printed and you got a different number. So the difference, and it's actually, it could be distance or difference. It's basically a straight line with three coordinates and you'll get a number. And that number is the delta E. And so the lower that number, the closer digitally they match. Now, there's been additional formulas that have been developed over time, and that's delta AB or delta 2000, which is probably the best one for a visual match. And there's a formula basically that says certain colors we see differently, like two yellows could be way off digitally, but to us, you wouldn't even be able to tell the difference between them two.
So I've heard this before, but you know, you usually see like a green, yellow, blue or something like that on any product. You pretty much look up that's mass produced. And someone said that is used for like a color test for the printer.
Oh, are you talking about when you see like a little color bar or something?
Yeah.
On a product, it'll be like hidden on a flap or something.
Yeah, and that's for machines to make sure that the color blue or the color red is that brand's color.
So I can explain this. The printing that I did was not so heavily focused on packaging, but we did do some things like that. And I do understand when you see, like if you buy a box of cereal or whatever and you open it up and you see like a color bar that's kind of printed on the inside somewhere. I believe, because I didn't do this, the type of mass production of boxes and things, but I believe that the reason that it's left in there is because of just print run optimization and it's hidden when it's all finished. So I guess they don't care that it's there. But with packaging, you end up with basically most printing is CMYK based. Basically, you have the CMYK inks. But a lot of packaging will use even more colors, and they call those spot colors, basically additional colors besides the CMYK process colors. And so that's why you may see a blue instead of like a cyan, or maybe just some other color like a green. Well, a green can be an overprint. I'm trying to make this where you can understand what I'm getting at on this. But a lot of packaging uses a lot of PMS colors, and sometimes they don't even have CMYK process inks in there. So they'll have this color bar there. And yes, a spectrophotometer does read that. And in probably mass production, the press sheet is a whole bunch of boxes laying flat. And there is a die, I would imagine, that is shaped where I think they call this the nested layout. So you got like a box and it's a weird shape and another box. And they kind of just nest in each other. So there's no waste, or almost like they try to get the percentage of waste down very low. And they print color bars in the spots that are going to glue in. And then as the sheets are running through the press or whatever type of press it is, there is inline spectrophotometers that can read color bars. Now, every setup is different, but they can read them in real time for the most part, or read them every 10 sheets or something. And it basically what happens is the press is running. It's running a color bar. It's reading, and these are called primaries, or sometimes they call them corner colors of the color space. And it reads it. It knows what the reference is supposed to be. And it gets the value and it goes, oh, we need to make this adjustment. So the adjustment can be made in real time. So the press is running. And when the delta E gets too far off of what the wet ink standard should be for that color, it gets more or less ink. So like the press is constantly adjusting as it's running and they're measuring that color bar every time. On the printing that I did, it wasn't runs like that because it wasn't like one product. It was just like anything you could imagine. So there would always be just a color bar that went across the whole top of the sheet. And so there's a bunch of ink zones and it would read it. And we were printing to a standard. So you may know if doing digital work, you may be familiar with some RGB color standards like Rec. 709 or what is the new one? Rec. 2020. And then you have sRGB, right? Those are color spaces that are RGB color spaces. And in CMYK, there are digital versions that are standards. Adobe products set everything to sheet fed, swap, something like that. You'll find most sheet fed printing is set up to Grackle. Grackle 2013, there's an uncoated, there's like a whole suite of color spaces. They range from like 1 to 7, depending on what kind of stock you're on. And those are just there so that everyone knows what the digital standard is, so that you can calibrate presses to those digital standards. And everyone's going to be off some. But if you have something that's digital that says, hey, everyone's targeting this, at least everything will be very close. And the color bars that are on the sheet, they measure those, and the reference comes from the standard. So like swap Grackle, that's what they're measuring and they're comparing it to. For PMS colors, they're measuring a PMS color and they're measuring back to the PMS digital library. And it says 485 should be this lab number. And if it's printing on a foil, they have like a whole special thing for different substrates that you're printing on. It goes really complicated, like printing on cardboard and whatever. But yeah, that's what the color bars are there. That's what they are. They're measuring it.
I love the fact that the printers are readjusting their colors in live time.
Yeah, especially packaging. Because you have on a store shelf, there's a whole bunch of them and they're all right next to each other. And you're going to be able to see when one looks real yellow and it's supposed to be brown or whatever, you're going to be able to see it. They're right there on top of each other. Maybe they all come from the same print run, but maybe they didn't. Maybe some of them are mixed in and there's another shipment come in. When you put them on the shelf, you're going to be able to see. So I would say that it's really important there for sure. For a newsletter or some magazine, maybe nobody cares because nobody's going to see 20 of them next to each other, probably.
And I'll say I have seen color variants on big products. And it's funny even hearing it from you, like how important it is and how much dedication goes into making sure these are accurate. And yet sometimes I'll still see the difference and I'm like, you know, somebody was like getting yelled at or there was some error or something, you know.
I'll tell you something that happens. Sometimes the make ready that's supposed to be thrown away ends up in production. And it could be that they're supposed to make 3,000 of them and they're like 50 short. Or I don't know what it could be, but they're like, well, we can load up the whole press again and it's going to cost this much money, or we can just grab this trash that we threw away and make some boxes or whatever. I'm not saying that's what happens, but make ready that's been thrown away has been made it into finals. Yes. So educating people that have been in the industry way longer than you is very difficult too, because people are just in their ways and you're trying to get everybody to do a digital standard that they don't completely understand, and they've just been doing the same thing they've always done. And that was, you're already having to fight with reality of how hard it is to do, but then you're fighting with employees as well, trying to get them to do what you need them to do.
You know, it's funny. I kind of had a crazy story about where we at work, everybody was using the same hex code and the same color key, but it looked different on everyone's monitors. And it was like, literally stopped production at my old job for almost 2 days. And we realized it was the different monitors were showing completely different colors. And then on top of that, there's color spaces, especially on Mac laptop or like any Mac product, that you can change and adjust. So we had to like kind of make a universal color space that we were all using. I think we went with 1998 Apple RGB. For anybody that has Apple products, I think from the mass amount of research we did, that is the most color accurate to most universal printers. So the printing and the visualization on Mac screens, that's the best color space to use. So we all switched it to that.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of, in the prepress work, everything would be based on what Adobe's default color settings are. So if you didn't have an ICC profile embedded in an image or a document or whatever, you would just have to assume that, well, if they didn't mess with their color settings at all, it's probably sRGB or it's probably swap CMYK. And that was a good rule of thumb to go by. If there's no profile, that's probably what it is. It's just like interpreting footage, if you've ever done interpreting footage in After Effects or Premiere or whatever. Same thing. If there's no profile, if you interpret it differently, it's going to look differently, right? Same thing with printing. There's no ICC profile. The rip is interpreting it as well. We'll just guess. I guess it's probably what Adobe set it to.
Well, I'm excited to jump into a bit of your 3D work. I can't believe how fascinating printing is. Like, I just happened to, I forgot we, you're even a phenomenal 3D artist, man. So
yeah, I started the 3D stuff almost the same time I was learning prepress, I think. I was just doing it on my own on the side. It wasn't really relevant to the day job.
So how long have you been doing 3D? Because, I mean, your work feels like it's you've been doing it for years.
I have been now. I didn't think years had gone by, but years have gone by. I think that it's close to 10 years now or something. I was at the printer for like 8. I was doing 3D for a long time. I mean, I was very bad at it, but I still was doing it. I started out in a little program called Strata 3D. I think it was like a Mac store program, and I didn't know what to get. I just knew I was a Mac person because I was a Mac person for sure at that time, and I just needed something. My dad is an inventor. Invented this thing, and I knew that he needed help visualizing it and trying to get it drawn up. And I wanted to do the drawings because I'd always done stuff on the computer. I was like, I'm going to learn 3D and figure this out. And I went all the wrong ways. I was an inventor for a long time. I had an Autodesk. Yeah, I was trying to do it in that. And I was in Strata, and I was in Maya for, after all that. And then I landed on Cinema 4D. But it took me a while to like figure out my path and what I wanted to do. But yeah, everything was pretty hardcore then, you know, all materials, no stock models. You just built everything.
That's the best way. You know, I'm kind of almost, I feel like going backwards a little bit where I'm going more towards the basics because I just saw so many people doing dailies and I went on the daily train. And so I was very much just turbo squid download. I was heavily focused more on the composition. But now that I'm falling more in love with cool looking models, like it's like, I don't even care if there's a background or not. I just see a model that looks awesome. And I'm like, man, I want to know how to build that. So I'm like going back more to the basics and learning just about polygon movements and just fixing up the polygons, counting and trying to make it look as smooth as possible in areas. And
it is definitely difficult to like do dailies and have like a general following that is maybe not 3D or anything. And they just want to see a cool looking picture or something. And you're like, I'm doing this for me. Like my first set of dailies, I was just like, I just want to have a challenge so that I can learn something every day. And I knew the result was not going to be awesome. And I was just like, well, whatever. You just post it and you move on. You post it and you move on. And if people want to follow my little journey here, that's fine. but they're probably not going to want to print it out, put it on their wall, because it's not going to be, it's going to be a little task that I've learned.
Right.
So I did a year of dailies. Now, this last year, I just finished a year of dailies.
Oh, congratulations.
That was, yeah, it was hard. You know, people do it for, and they just keep doing it. I can't just keep doing it. My goal was to just look back and go, look at the first dailies I did and look at the last month or whatever. Are they like way better? Did I get way better? Because that's what it was about for me. And if they happen to look awesome and people like them, that's cool. But that was always what it was, that you grow doing it. And I do feel like that if you always are just using stock assets and using mega scans and just always using models, yeah, you're going to get better at, I feel like, photography or maybe, or like composition. Yeah. But I don't know. It depends on what you're doing. Like, I work for studios and agencies, and you just get requests and you, can you build this rig? Can you do this? Can you? Yeah, I can just do it. But I don't see you getting better if you don't have that there.
Yeah, 100%. To learn the real fundamentals, I think the thing that makes you next level is doing the cool building, the structure building, and learning everything the hard way. With Turbo Squid, when I started my dailies, I had zero experience in Cinema 4D. My first daily was in Cinema 4D, probably the first week I touched it. So using Turbo Squid was a saving grace, where I was able to learn about redshift, octane, lighting, materials, mixing materials. So I was able to learn a lot of the basics, which is the one good thing that I felt like Turbo Squid was allowed to, just at that point, was allowed for me to mess around with basic things that I was terrible at, but then have a cool 3D model. So I was like, well, at least it looks kind of cool. At least it's not complete shit. But I learned the fog, you know, volumetric lighting.
When I do render, some days it would be like, I don't have any more ideas. Like, I've done everything. I like, don't know. And I just pull up Pinterest and I'm like, I don't want to copy somebody, but if you attempt to, if you like, I cool render, let me try to do that same render. It'll be different. Even if you try, it'll be a different render.
100%.
Yeah. So I would do that. But also, I swear, some of the days I work the longest and I'm like, I should be done with this. I try to do stuff in like 2 hours, or just get it 2 hours. And I'm like, this is just garbage. Like, I don't know. And so I would have my crutches and I'd be like, I think this one's going to get a lens flare or something, because I would just go in After Effects, throw a lens flare on it. Okay, it's way better now than it was.
Yeah.
Post it. Or I'll go in Photoshop and paint some stuff, or I'll do like I'll throw a gradient map on it and try to do some funky thing with it just to save it, to get it out. But some days they end up coming straight out of render and I don't really touch them. They work pretty good. But yeah, I had my crutches for sure, trying to just, I don't know, paint something on it to make it work.
Yeah, I always used a Topaz was one. I still,
oh yeah,
that one's such a cheat sheet. It's just like, make look good. All right, thank you.
Yeah, Rev was, he used that and he was telling me about it. And I never did get it. When I learned about it, it was like in November, very close to the end, and I just didn't buy it. Most of the time I just go in Photoshop. Some of the tricks I do, I'll use the gradient tool in Photoshop to like make the edges dark or whatever, to just give it a little more emphasis on one object or whatever, because I can't seem to pull it off nice with real lighting. I'll fake the lighting, or sometimes, I don't know, I do whatever I can. Or particles are a crutch for me, because if I don't have any ideas, I always can make particles something look good pretty fast.
One of my main tricks, that this one's terrible too, but I just make it into like a magazine. So I shrink it down and then just throw a drop shadow and add a light, a little poster.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's an idea.
Yeah, it's just literally shrinking it down.
One of the ones that I do, like if most of the renders are on a dark background, I'll just invert it with a gradient map in Photoshop. And then all of a sudden it's on a white background and you get a completely... It's like, wow, it looks way better. Like, all of a sudden, I'm just minimalist, just this minimalist design. I don't know. So that's one that I'll do it a lot of times. I'll drop it in Photoshop, and the first thing I'll do is I'll invert it. I'm like, nope, not that. I'll just try like five things that I know to go to. Like, do that. Okay, that one works for this render, and then it's done. But you can't put a whole lot of, I don't know. I just let it go. I got used to just posting them, even if they're just not good. I'm like, whatever.
Yeah, you have to. I'll just say the other last, this is for anybody listening that might ever look at my dailies. This is my last little cheat I'll do. I don't want to give all the secrets away. But I always find if you add tiny text in the corner, just make it...
Yes, a little block, yeah, of something.
So cheap, but if you ever zoom in, it's just me and I'm writing stuff like, this is the worst secret in all of humanity. Like, I should be ashamed of myself. But if you zoom in...
Well, it's part of like this, like a HUD type thing or something, yeah.
Right, exactly.
I used it in graphic design at some point, like with some poster design a while back. I remember doing some things like that, yeah. Just putting something there. You can't read what it is, something.
It just makes it look like, oh, that's information. This is must be a complicated thing. What is this green thing in a tube?
Yeah.
Ridiculous. So what kind of programs are you doing in your dailies? Because your renders are very clean. I love your color palette. You always got like super bright colors going on.
It's Redshift, and I use Cinema. I use X Particles. I use Redshift. My first set of dailies a couple years ago, half of them were Octane because I moved straight from physical to Octane, like version 2.5 or something. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I want to learn Redshift. Everybody's talking about Redshift. So it was one of those things. My first set of dailies, I didn't start like at the first of the year and end of the year. I started a weird date. So at the first of the year, I was like, I'm going to do every daily with Redshift. And let me tell you, it was bad. The first render was like a display sphere or something. You can go look at it. It was very simple. I couldn't, because it was just like Octane was pretty easy, and it took me a while to make Redshift sing, like make it look good. But now, and I hear people say this all the time, I can't, Redshift doesn't look as good. I'm like, bull. You can make Redshift look really, really good. There are a very few instances where Octane excels way better, but there are a lot of stuff that it can do. As long as you got your GI right, it can do, and it's going to render it faster and cleaner. So yeah, there's not going to be any noise. That can be a problem too with Redshift, where you're like, I need noise, and Octane just kind of has that noise there.
It's naturally bad.
Yeah, just naturally. But sometimes you want it. So like, there have been renders where I'm just like, and it's mostly with volumes. I'm like, the volume is just too damn clean because it renders volumes clean. I'm just overlaying things to try to get what I want in there. And sometimes Octane, it just naturally looks great on some things. So yeah. Anyway, so I use, stuff from Red Giant just for like some post stuff, maybe. Usually it's a glow or something. But I used a program called, is it called Gaia? It's basically like a... to build terrains. It is very fast, and the viewport looks really good compared to some of these other ones like World Creator. And basically it has all the erosion tools and things, so you can like get some very nice results for your terrains, and you can export the models at different, what do you call it, LEDs?
Yeah, level of detail.
Yeah, you can export them out at different ones, or you can just do displacement maps or color maps. And so you can get exactly what color information you want out of there, where the vegetation is or whatever, and bring it in. And then I use Forester.
I was just going to say, how does that compare to Forester?
Oh, well, I don't actually get vegetation out of... You can use the vegetation maps with Forester, if that makes sense. So you say, I only want a clone on this area. And so you've displaced it, and then you got the map for where the clones are going to go. But you can do so many things with it. And then you use those maps with Redshift as a mask and et cetera, you know, however you're going to do your nodes. It's very hard to kind of do. I only did a few with that. But this year I wanted to branch off. I was like, I need a landscape program, and I don't want to use... I wanted something much more modern. And that the speed of the GPU and how high res and the feedback that you get with it, I really like it, and it wasn't very hard to use. Wow. It has a lot of things in it where you just click and you're like, I just want a mountain or I just want a crater. And you just drag a node over and you pretty much have a crater multiplied on top of something else. It's very, I don't know, I just watched the tutorials and started learning. And it was like $200, no subscription. So anytime you have no more subscriptions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, like $200. But
that's Gaia, right? Gaia.
Yeah. Okay. Gaia. It's like G-A-E-A or something like that.
I love checking out new programs, because to be honest, I feel like terrain is one thing that takes a while, especially to get some good results. I love putting in some good mountains in the background, just like a lot of terrain and depth, because that's what gives it real depth, when you can throw in those elements in the distance.
I put it in the chat if that works.
Oh, okay. Yeah, quad spinner. Okay.
Yeah, if you check out their stuff, it's like a modern, it's a very modern software. It's not like something that's been around a long time, I don't think. At least that's the way it feels anyway.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to try this out because this looks awesome. And also, if it's not subscription-based, I've just kind of gotten so sick of it. I had Redshift even as the perpetual license, and then now it's back to the monthly, and it's annoying because I actually just got mad at Redshift. I just sent them an email 2 weeks ago, but I couldn't get my perpetual license onto my laptop, so I had to buy a monthly subscription. And they're like, well, we know we stopped the perpetual halfway through your license. So
it's been so confusing because I had a Redshift license, but then I had Red Giant Complete. Then Maxon buys Red Giant, and then they buy Redshift. And then I'm like, I juggled one account. Then they merged another account. I got three accounts. Now I got Maxon One, and then they charge me for Maxon One, and they charge me for Universe. Yep. I'm like, hold on. Universe is included, right? They're like, yeah, and then they refunded it and everything. But it was just so confusing because I had three different accounts and to make sure that all that worked out and get it taken care of. But yeah, I'm working on building another workstation as soon as I can get parts and everything. But I'll have to have a separate Redshift license, another one. For me, and this is probably the way it's always been with software, working with studios and things, they ask, do you know Cinema? Do you know Redshift? Yes. And the good thing about Redshift is a lot of studios will be working in Maya and they'll throw their Cinema projects to freelancers. And so they're working in Redshift and Maya. And so I've even had, I believe, assets that were in Maya with Redshift materials come over to Cinema.
One thing I like about Redshift is that right now on my laptop with the M1 chip, I got the new Apple MacBook. It works. I'm not going to lie to you. I've always loved Apple products. My desktop, obviously a PC, but everything else is Mac-based. And I've been wanting to get a PC or a laptop for so long, and I just couldn't bring myself necessarily to get an Apple product if I couldn't do any like GPU rendering with 3D. And so then I heard about the M1 chip, and I don't know if you know, do you know Tokyo Megaplex, Chris Rutledge?
I know that. I've heard it.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. He does a lot of Adult Swim work, and
okay,
he's chill with the MoGraph podcast guys. He used to come to some meetups in New York. I think he's in LA now. He's always been a huge Redshift person. And what's cool too about Redshift is, yeah, Maya, Cinema 4D, and he works in Houdini, and it's flawless for him. So it's a really powerful rendering program. But with the M1 chip on the Apple computer, it works great. And that was a big selling point, is to connect all my devices and finally be able to do real-time rendering. So
yeah, I want one of those new when everyone was talking about it, and you seen Jules on the Apple thing and everything. You know, I was looking into, I was like, yeah, it looks pretty awesome. Yeah, it's got 64 gigs of VRAM. It still doesn't hang with a 3090 or a 3080 or whatever laptop you can get that's like a gaming laptop. But it's so damn slick and everything. I mean, yeah.
And they're sturdy. I'm not going to lie. I've had multiple laptops. I feel like in 2 years, they're just dead. The battery, the software, I don't know. The customer service is bad. But I have every single Mac laptop I have, and they still work.
Yeah, I had an old 17. It was like the last NVIDIA one. Actually, that was where I downloaded my first demo of Octane. Like, I first, like, I'm rendering GPU, you know? I thought it was fast as shit, but it was slow. But yeah, I thought it was fast. But yeah, I had like their demo scene open, and it was rendering. I remember I was on, I was out of town, and I was at I was eating breakfast at a hotel, and I had my laptop down there, and I got that thing running right there at the table. It was amazing to me that it looked so good. And I didn't understand a lot of stuff then why it looked good. I just knew it looked good. That's what did it. And then from there, I had two 680s. And then I got two 980 Ti's. And then I bought two more Titans. And then I was rolling.
Yeah.
Just kept rolling with it. And that's when we thought $700 was a lot of money for a GPU.
Oh, the good old days.
I used to $700. Ah, yeah, but it's worth it though. Look what it's doing though. But now, spend so much money on GPUs.
Yeah, I'm hoping they make some kind of fix to the Ethereum 2.0 just needs to come out. So there's just no more. Nobody needs to do no farming. Yeah, it's intense. Well, I guess we'll even ask this. How do you get inspiration? And what is your main source for inspiration?
I don't know. So I don't know. It's hard. So we have meetups here in Nashville. We have our Music City MoGraph meetup, and it comes up my dailies. It comes up. What are you going to do for your daily, or would you do your daily or whatever? And I just like start taking requests. I'm like, whatever you just give me an idea and I'll do it. I don't care. And I feel like it's like a musician taking requests or whatever. So that helps me a whole lot because they generally do. Sometimes the ideas are like, well, that's going to take a long time. I don't know. Like, what if you do this and then that? And sometimes it's like, wow, that's a really cool, interesting. So, yeah. But also Pinterest, just like searching things. And I get ideas from renders, but also get ideas from just other things that are cool compositions. There's probably just like art installations or something where I'm just like, that looks really cool. And then I'll have that in my head, but then it never comes out to be that. And I don't want to copy people's stuff. But everyone is just feeding off everyone. I don't know. If you can get ideas outside of a 3D daily ecosystem of ideas, then it'd be great. But
this guy's named Shakespeare. I talked to him and he said something very interesting. He's got a very unique style and look to his 3D. So I was just curious on where he gets his inspiration. He said he never looks at anybody else's work. He only looks for like architectural... can't remember where he was saying his sources were, but it was like everything but 3D.
Architecture stuff, I heard that look at dams, the images of dams, like all the shapes that they have, they're real good for like sci-fi architecture and stuff. So that was something I heard. Yeah, you just look at it, you're like, oh, that would actually look cool if it was just like shiny metal or something.
Yeah. So when it comes to your dailies, are you still doing the dailies or what's your plan with that?
Now I'm working on my new reel. Which, with all the dailies, that's a lot of projects to go through. So some of them I'm opening back up, and they're having to be revised, and everything is rendering in UHD. If you noticed, all my dailies are just square. I don't know why I stuck with that. I stayed with the 1x1. So now the composition's different, so it may work or may not. So I'm just having to change everything, and then I have a lot of projects that I did for studios, and I'm gonna have to go back and say, is this okay? Can I use this? Are you guys gonna, is it gonna be okay if I do this? And there's some stuff that's been hanging around for a while that I've been wanting to show. So when you work for a studio, a lot of times, sometimes you're just a small part on it and you can't really own anything. So it's really hard to ever show anything. So dailies really help you build a reel to at least show somebody, look what I can do. Because working for studios, they don't really give you much. But sometimes some of the studios, I do the whole thing, you know. I just delivered renders, you know, render frames, and I like that the best, of course. And I think they do too. No render time for them or anything. Just do it all. So.
But yeah, I think what's also great about doing dailies is a lot of times it is hard to do artwork that you want to do. Sometimes you just get so stuck doing artwork for other people that it's like you almost come to hate doing the art, or you think that's what you don't want to do anymore. It's like, this is so corporate, or this is so basic, or just not what I want. And then with dailies, it's just great.
You might have a month where you're not proud of the stuff. Sometimes I was on a project for a month and I didn't have time to do dailies, but I had to get them out. Some of my buddies were like, man, your stuff's been kind of sucking lately, you know, not really been there. You need to do a real good one here soon.
Yep.
So, yeah, I do have some patches in there where I'm just like going through and I'm like, yeah, there was nothing good for a while, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's where I was going with the drawing thing. I meant to say was that they were really bad, my drawings. And that's why I need to make a separate daily account. Yeah, it's been like weeks of just doing terrible drawings. I'm like, I can't post this on my account. These are terrible.
Yeah, like if you really care about followers and everything, it could be that, like, I feel like you do have to like tailor to that and have, you only want to post great stuff because you want your feed to look a certain way. And my feed is inconsistent as hell. Like you look through it and like everyone's like day after day, but it's not going to be consistent because I don't really have at least I don't feel like I have a style. You know, it just goes all over the place. Oh, I was going to talk about, you know, doing stuff that you want to do.
Yeah.
And I've heard this before from a lot of people, like if you don't do dailies to have stuff to put in your reel or to show, then you're never going to get hired, I feel like, for the stuff that you want to do. So, like, I always, almost always get from a lot of studios, it's usually about particles. And I never intended to be, like, the particle guy or ex-particles person, but it just happened to kind of go with dailies. It was a lot easier to just kind of, it was like infinite learning to, like, keep diving into it and diving into it. And so now, because my current reel, which is a couple years old, is mostly particles, that's what I get called for a lot of times. And I never intended that. And I could do modeling and all these other things, but it doesn't really matter because my reel has that on it, if that makes sense.
No, 100%. And I've heard that before too. And I can't agree more that if you're not putting out work that you want to do, then no one's going to know to hire you for that work. So that's what you have to do.
You have to do the dailies.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, you got to be putting out your own work. I'm excited to see your new reel. Do you have a date for when you're planning on putting
it out? Oh, man. I probably should set a date so that I will get it done. I rendered, I don't know, I've been, it's going to be a lot of re-rendering because nowadays I ask, you know, this is learned, I haven't been freelancing a long, long time, but I learned early now, it's like, what are the specs? If it's UHD, it's going to take way longer, way more money figuring all this out. So a lot of projects aren't UHD, but I want them for my reel. My reel is always UHD. Everything is, I don't upscale anything. And maybe you can get away with this with some of this AI stuff and upscale, but everything is rendered at UHD. I don't do denoising rarely. If it's very shallow, like lots of big bokeh and lights, maybe I will denoise it using an After Effects. I don't know what it's called.
I've switched to Topaz, so I've that for that.
Oh, it has denoising in it?
Yeah, they're pretty much, I want to say, like the kings of the artificial intelligence right now.
How do you do it on like image sequences? Will it do it?
Well, so I have to render out the image sequence into like an MOV or...
Oh, okay.
And then from there, but it also has an upscaler that's phenomenal. So it's kind of cheap. And some of my friends have done some insane stuff. I'm like, damn, how long did that take to render? And they're like, not long at all, which is good for dailies too, just an idea. But yeah, you can like totally make something minimal, 720 almost, upscale it, put a denoiser on it. And yeah, and it mind-blowing results.
Usually particles don't like that stuff.
Oh, I didn't even think about, because that's got to be even crazier.
But yeah, and the particles are difficult to post to social media because of compression and et cetera. But yeah, Neat Video, that's the one that I've used for years. Yeah. And it always seems to have, like you can dial in the profile and just, it always is the best preserving detail, everything I've used. That doesn't mean there's not some better. Red Giant has one in there. I think it's just called Denoise. But it's not as good, in my opinion, as Neat Video. It's a plugin that's been out for years and years. And I think that early DSLRs that were pretty noisy, but you were able to use, you know, the lenses and everything, get the great depth of field, but they just didn't have very clean from Canon and so on. That's where I first learned shooting video on DSLRs that were noisy and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Now Sony and stuff has got super great video. But basically, Neat Video, and it's not too much. But every time there's a new major version of After Effects or something, and they got some Premiere plugins, et cetera, but you have to buy the plugin for each thing. And then every time there's a new version, you'll probably have to buy the new one. But it's not very much. Yeah, but I think it's the best one. It's still my best one.
I might have to do that and do a nice, maybe that'll be a little tutorial video doing a comparison.
Yeah, you should compare and then compare the ones in Redshift too. Redshift has got optics in there built in, and then there's another one, but I compared them a while. Neat Video is just the best one. I mean, maybe things have changed, but I just stick with that one. But usually I just put the samples where they should be, and I usually don't denoise stuff.
That's the best way to do it. I mean, I just do it the right way.
I don't know. It's just because I want it to be, it's got to be awesome. It's got to be badass. Yeah, I don't usually do it, but it depends. It depends on what's going on. Like if we don't have time, then I'll do what I have to do.
Yeah, and it's funny too that you mentioned going back. I actually kind of had to do the same thing with my reel, which I'm just glad I had everything saved, but I was doing the 13 by 1080. Was it 1380 by 1080 for Instagram? Is that the dimensions? But anyway, I was using those dimensions, and then when I wanted to put it in my reel, I had to go back to all my dailies and then re-export it.
Oh, it's so much. Well, I was using like I have some logo animations that I did, and they have animated lens flares on the edges and stuff, and it's all, and it's got like 3D data coming in, After Effects from Cinema for this stuff. And now it's in UHD, and I'm having a hard time, like, everything is off because After Effects uses pixel units for dimensions. And then when you change that, everything is way off. There might be a solution. I didn't know the solution, but I basically had to like, you're going like 6 months back and you're like,
yeah,
I got to re-render this part, put them together. And I have to basically rebuild the whole comp in After Effects the way I built it before and then render that out. And now I got my footage for my reel for it to show up for a second and a half or whatever it's going to be on there.
Exactly. Yep.
It's so much work. But for me, the reel is, it's got to be better than the last one. It's got to be just, you know, it's a sizzle. It's got to be good. So yeah, I don't know when it'll be done.
I would love for an app. I mean, Instagram's finally, I mean, they with reels and stuff, they finally allowed for a platform for like dailies to kind of look good in some, and even the photos I think have gotten way higher res to what it was 2 years ago.
Yeah. Well, Twitter has gotten way better because it used to kill on anything. My trick has been Vimeo on everything, and I would just post the link. But sometimes the thumbnails do some weird stuff. But I don't know. It was a challenge to post to all the platforms every day. And if you on my Vimeo, I have animations, and I was like, how am I gonna post this? It would be crazy. Sometimes I post natively, sometimes not.
I just got the Vimeo like Pro. Does it have any cool features that maybe came out in the last 2 years that you should know about?
I mean, I have it. I think the only reason I got it is because, and this was me, and I saw the difference. I upload ProRes 422 to Vimeo, and I feel like that always had the best possible, because they would do their conversion on the back end, however, and my particle work always looked the best doing that. Before then, my storage limit was so small, I couldn't put really, especially doing dailies, because it's like a weekly upload limit. I'd be like, I'd upload one, and if I didn't like it, I need to replace another one. Well, I hit my limit then.
Tough shit, yeah.
Yeah. So that was it, and I think you can customize the player a little more.
Yeah, it's cool. They have a client mode, which is nice. So I know I've done it in the past for clients where I'll make the border their branding colors because they are obsessed with it.
Yeah.
I actually got it because they have a little fun feature, which this might be a great segue into VR, but I found out a little cheat. I might be one of the first people to figure this out, but in VR, it's hard for, I guess, videos to upload because there's so much data around. But for some reason, if you use a Vimeo link, you can use a .mp4. They're called direct links. So essentially, you are accessing the video file directly in the server, bypassing like the streaming service, I guess, of going to a media player then. So where it's going from like the direct file to a media player to the input. But if you get Pro on Vimeo, you can get a direct link access, which you can't do on pretty much anything. You can't even do it on Google Drive. You can't do it on Dropbox. You can't do it on anything. You can only pretty much do it if you have an actual server or Vimeo. And yeah, so I would take those. And now I have these worlds with multiple videos playing at the same time. Whereas before, I would have to wait 20 to 30 seconds for each video to upload. And yeah, I have not seen anybody's worlds match what mine's doing. It's a cool feature Vimeo has.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because I guess you would be hosting the video, right?
Essentially, exactly.
Yeah, you're not hosting it now.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it is, yeah.
Well, so anyway, speaking of which, have you done anything in VR? What's your experience in VR or AR?
No, not yet. I know I feel bad about it. I mean, I got a lot of friends who everyone's talking about a new Rococo suit coming out and they've got them ordered. And I was seriously looking at it really close. And I was like, I don't do Rococo stuff. Well, of course I don't because I don't have one, you know. And so you have to get one first, right? And it's kind of the same thing with VR. I was like, I don't do VR stuff because I don't have one. So I have to buy one to find out if I do VR stuff. And I still haven't done it. And I don't know, people around me and people I talk to at Discord, etc., they've had several sets and I still haven't messed with it. I don't know if I see people like sculpting or see videos of people sculpting and stuff in it. I don't know if I would actually do that. I don't know. It is interesting though. People are doing a lot of stuff, but no, I would say I'm pretty green at it. I just wouldn't know what to get. What is the one?
Yeah. I mean, for anybody listening, yeah, and I'll say the Quest, I mean, there's rumors that there's going to be a new Quest coming out within a month or two. So if you wanted to wait, cool. If not, it's only $300. And literally, I think the government might even be suing for Facebook because they're taking such a huge loss on every single headset that they're saying that they're pretty much forcing the market into their own hand. And they're like, no one can compete with you guys because you're just taking such a loss to make sure you claim the market.
So if you buy that headset from them, are you like in their, like, is there like a marketplace for stuff that they're hosting and you're buying stuff directly from them? Or is it like compatible with third party stuff? Or is,
so what's nice is it has the full capability of linking directly to your PC. So if you do that, you have unlimited access to everything PC. Like, you can go into Steam, you can download all the Steam games, and it runs off essentially your computer directly to your headset. And it's, dare I say, completely flawless. It's amazing. And you're going to be looking like you're on like $1 million headset. It's awesome. Then there's the standalone mode where that is run directly off of the headset and you are pretty much only able to play games that are featured in the Oculus store. And there's hundreds of games, like a lot of painting apps and just so many creative artist apps that are just phenomenal. And what's even fun is the other night, so we also do meetups every Sunday from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Come on, check it out. We do virtual reality meetups and it's awesome. I was so blown away. I've never tried it before, but you know, I'm moving. You can see like,
yeah,
I was at my new apartment, which we don't have internet yet. I used my cell phone to connect to my headset because it's a standalone. And it worked great. I was hanging out with people at the meetup, talking, you know.
I saw some stuff on your Discord, but I wasn't, well, first off, I don't have a headset. you have to just buy one and then you like got, you can't, I don't know. You got to have one. I don't know anybody who has one.
Definitely get the Oculus Quest.
Okay. Well, it's got, I mean, I've just been hearing and hearing about this thing. So, and from other people too, they were like, well, this one was okay, but this newest one, and they must be talking about that one. I haven't really paid a lot of attention, I guess. I'm looking at Substance Modeler, which is like a sculpting coming out, and they were talking about how you could do some sculpting in VR, or you could do it on the desktop. And I was like, I don't know how, maybe that would be more intuitive or less intuitive. Either one I'm not good at. Sculpting, so maybe it's a plus either way. But yeah, that's as far as I've thought about it for sure.
So, well, I want to jump into this next question because, man, this has been such a great episode. I'm having such a blast here.
Oh, good.
I want to hit one last thing that, just because it's a hot topic and I just love getting everyone's opinion on it. What do you think about NFTs? Have you sold any NFTs? Have you minted it?
No. Well, to be honest, I didn't want to try, I guess, because I didn't want to. This is one of these things where you're like scared to fail. What is my art worth? Once someone decides it, then have I set my journey? Like, have I set what my art is worth forever? So once my first piece is sold, and it sold for some, I don't know, one ETH or whatever, does that have put a label on me?
Right.
So I haven't sold anything. Well, first off, back when Beeble blew up last year, 15 months ago now, like last November, whenever.
Yeah, it's been just about a year, right?
I did, like a lot of people, I applied to a lot of the platforms, and I tried to get on Super Rare, I tried Maker's Place. I did little videos that they ask and everything, and I got no response. They claim that it's just that they're backed up with so many artists, but it's been a year or whatever. And I guess my work wasn't good enough, or I don't have enough followers, or not known enough. And so I kind of left it at that. I only applied at those two platforms. And then I was lucky. I got an invite to Foundation through, it's a long story, David Ariev's wife. He gave me a link and I was able to get on the platform, and I'm on there and I was like, okay, I can do this now. And then I still had my dailies going on, and I think studio projects, and I was thinking about, I was like, I don't want to mess this up. And so I never did anything with it. And I still haven't, but I have hard wallet. And I've invested in different things and just as an investments.
Yeah.
Ethereum and Solana, I have some of that. And I have some Render token and I've invested and it's all done good. Well, everything's way down now, but I'm still way good on that. But I haven't bought any NFTs and I haven't sold any. And I feel like it's a, from my point of view and what I know about branding and my branding background and the focus I put on that, I feel like that to be successful, it's not all about like how awesome it looks. I feel like it's got to do with your marketing. And I feel like that your self-branding as an artist, what do people think about when they see your profile online or when they see you respond to something, the way that you present yourself online, it matters more than anything, I would think. It matters so much. I felt like that was really important before I ever posted my first thing. So I still haven't posted anything on there. So and I didn't know how big a deal with having anything on Foundation was. I was like, how is it really that exclusive of a platform? Yeah, is it really going to matter? I was happy to finally get accepted to one. I didn't get accepted. Somebody invited me. So that's where I've been with it.
I think this is probably one of the most unique responses and probably, I want to say, one of the most accurate responses on how people will collect it. I mean, yeah, you're right. It's a brand. I mean, somebody else said the other day, too, that they feel like if you want to make it in the NFT game, you have to almost make it a full-time job getting your artwork noticed. And being a brand is probably the better word to say, is how strong is your personal brand? And that's more, yeah, what people are probably buying the NFT from.
When they think of you or when you're brought up in conversation, and this is the same thing with companies, and you can think of all the big companies that have good brands or whether or not you think about whether you like them or not. When people think of Apple, and I always use Apple for an example almost all the time, branding. If you look at my background, I studied branding very hard just as something I really wanted to do with graphic design. Why is their brand so strong? Why is Tesla's brand so strong? What is it about it? I don't know. It's such a hard thing. It's psychology. So for me, it's been, you see the amount of effort that goes into like every email I write, I check it. My signature looks a certain way. I pay quite a bit of money to host my signature on a secure server so that it doesn't get pinged for spam. It's like these little details all the way down, my custom domain for my email, all of that stuff mattered. And that's just to self-brand myself to studios, to brand yourself to NFT collectors. I don't know. I feel like I'm learning. I don't know. So that's where I am on that. And it is expensive, too, dealing with Ethereum. I was watching Solana, and I don't know what to think about it. I'm watching the both of them.
One thing I do like, too, about NFTs is I feel like it can hold value. So it's like another way of kind of like retaining your Ethereum while also double banking on somebody else's success. So if they really trust in your brand and they think you're going to continue to grow your brand, that you're also not only retaining that Ethereum, but you also have that extra potential bonus in this person's artwork or success in their career.
Yeah.
And just to kind of wrap around to your first point that I might say, and maybe you're not saying you're scared, but I think for myself personally, there is a fear too of, yeah, being labeled of like how much you are worth as an artist.
Because you know the artist, it's subjective. I'm not saying this works for everybody. Maybe people sell stuff pretty cheap and then maybe they have big sales when they get on more established platforms. But I do know that if Beeple decides to bid on one of your pieces, obviously, all of a sudden, your brand is shot up and now it's got a lot of attention and people, well, Beeble did this, then it depends. If Snoop Dogg owns one of your NFTs, oh, well, this artist must. So there's so many things that can matter in that. It is about the art for me, but of course, you probably see all these PFP projects where the art's just like, it doesn't seem to matter much. It just, right? So
Yeah, it's an interesting field, and I'm excited to dive into it eventually, maybe once I get over my fear, if you will, on it. Yeah, and also, I'll even just point this out. Another fear I might be having is putting myself out there for, like, please buy my work. I like it when people come to me asking for my stuff, and I feel like with NFTs, I'm asking people to support me. I don't know. It's just like a different dynamic that I'm not used to. And
yeah, no. I mean, that is a challenge. It seems like... if I were to do it, it seems like that you would definitely need help from more established artists, maybe, or at some point you're able to shill your work. It's like, hey, this is my first drop, and hopefully you do it in the right way and you set yourself on the right course instead of just going at it without really thinking about what your consequences are and messing up your reputation in the NFT space, I guess, if you want to call it that. But
yeah, and that's too, like, I've just heard that there's such a different group when it comes to the NFT world. Like, it's like a completely separate universe, you know, with like the NFT artist and all of the big whales in that space. And apparently you can get really lost in there. And I've heard, like, once you dive into that world, you just think everything's an NFT.
People disappear and you're like, what happened to them? And then you talk to him one time, it's like, man, I've just been like watching all these charts and you're just watching it like crazy. And you can, it's just 24 and it never shuts down. Like crypto market doesn't shut down.
Yeah. I can't imagine the stock market if it never shut down.
Yeah. You just like watch it. You don't know what's happening. It's like any time of the day, night, wake up, look at your phone. What's going on? Why is everything way down? What happened?
Right.
What happened? Why did everything drop? Right?
Really? Yeah. It's a different world. Well, man, Vernon, it has been amazing talking with you.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Is there any little last things you want to share before we go?
So all my influences, I like follow some people. So like, I don't know if you know these people. You know Silverwing, Raphael Rao, I guess his name.
Yeah, that.
So this guy's like super talented into like rendering. So early on, like that guy was a super big influence for me. Learning Octane starting out, he did like some talks online. I followed him, and then Simon Holometal, I guess is how you say his name. This guy's like a super awesome Houdini artist. Basically, every awesome like micro particle thing you ever seen that looked like for Nike or whatever, everybody uses his work for reference. He's the guy that makes the badass stuff. That's part. He's the badass Houdini guy. He is the guy, I would say. And then Mario Tranfolk, I guess that's how you say his name. He is the creative director for I think Insidium still. He's pretty much the guy making the awesome X Particles reels. I'm sure that, well, there's other people, and like John Bosley. There's other people, but like that guy, like these are the people that I like look up to, and like have like I'm gonna make work like them. So I'd say that. I'm just trying to give credit where, and Beeple, I never really followed him for his artwork style, but his work ethic basically made me do dailies. So if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't have done dailies.
Same here. Beeple was the number one reason for me doing this.
Yeah.
I'm excited to check out a few of them in the real. I might have, but the names just weren't jumping to my mind. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to seeing what you do.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.